Welcome to the Vader Studios podcast, Studio Confessions, episode 2. With me today, we have singer and guitarist from the band The Enemy, solo artist in his own right, and obviously songwriter, Mr. Tom Clark.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the show. Can you say that? Do you say that on a podcast?
I don't know.
You don't listen to me.
Do you say that on a podcast?
Don't know. It's the second time I've ever done it.
Peaking early.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But really nice to have you on the show and to talk about your time as a recording artist. And obviously you and I we've been working together making records for 18 years.
Is it 18 years now?
It will be 18 years in April. It's pretty scary, isn't it? Yeah. And obviously we worked together on The Enemy and we're still working together now to this day on your solo records. We're nearly three in now, nearly completed the third. Mm. And that's why I thought it'd be great to have you on the show to talk about your whole kind of journey throughout that. And obviously, I wasn't the first person you'd recorded with. What was your first recording experience?
I think you were the first proper recording experience. But the first time I went into a room which was called a studio would have been at secondary school.
Oh, okay.
Which is unusual. But I went to a school in a part of Birmingham called Castle Bromwich, and the school was called Parkhall School. And it had a really, really good music department. The rest of the school was sort of failing and the GCSE results were terrible and it actually was knocked down and turned into an academy. But the music department was brilliant and there was a room in that school called The Studio, where they had a Logic rig.
Okay.
So I was exposed to sort of computers that recorded music probably around age 11. And then we had an entire room with computers by the time I left that school years later, which were all... It probably wouldn't have been Logic, it would have maybe been Cubase.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there were lots of those and we were learning about MIDI for GCSE. It was the very beginning of my sort of introduction to MIDI back then. And then the first time I was recorded in a recording studio was at Music College, where I met Liam and Andy. Mm-hmm. There was a proper studio in there with probably a 16-channel desk or something, but it had, it was a soundproof, acoustically treated room. And for I think it was the guys in the year above for their coursework, they needed to record someone. And I remember going into that studio and them miking me up and me just performing something that I'd written and them recording it. So that was my first sort of recording in a recording studio. And then me and Liam, while we were at college, formed a band called Bridges. And we went into two studios to record tracks for Bridges. One was called J10, and it was in Coventry on the A45 in I think it was an old substation building or something. Had a huge control room and quite a small live room, which seemed backwards. But the guy there, his name was Paul. He was really enthusiastic. And the other one was a guy called Daz, and it was just in an industrial estate. But again, me and you would walk into it and we go, okay, acoustically it's not great, but we could record there. Mm. Like we could make it work, and it was very basic. Like better than my home studio setup now. But then, my first time, I think, really properly recording well in a studio was when we started working with you in Old Vader.
Old Vader. That was 2006, April. I'm going to say it was April the 3rd, 2006. We recorded 40 Days, 40 Nights, Back Like a Heart Attack, and I can't remember the third
Dancing
one.
Dancing All Night?
It was Dancing All Night, yeah. And that was on Logic. I was using Logic then. And you didn't get involved in terms of, touching Logic at all then.
No.
It's weird because I can't, I remember for years you not being particularly, not like you weren't disinterested, but you weren't actively using Logic. And then all of a sudden you use Logic almost every day of your life. At what point did you start getting a bit more interested in the whole, like, I think I'm going to start getting a bit of this recording in myself?
So while we were out touring We'll Live and Die in These Towns, there was sort of mounting pressure from the record label to have written the second record, but, you know, whilst touring the world. Mm. And, you know, I touring for me, I find so exhausting. I didn't really have the capacity to be writing songs whilst on tour. So I was sort of getting more and more stressed about the fact that this record, this second record's looming. And people were saying to me on that tour, oh, so-and-so from such-and-such a band we've worked with has his laptop on the back lounge of the tour bus, and he just demos songs there, which was a complete joke because the back lounge of our tour bus was just a constant party, so there would have been no recording on there. But it did make me think, okay, well, you know, I can remember from school working with MIDI, maybe I could just sort of get a basic rig and demo some songs. So I just moved into my first flat and I got a laptop. And the first song that I ever demoed on my own was Sing When You're In Love, which ended up on the second record. So that's when I started. But I was always quite frustrated. I was using Logic, and back then I found it quite unintuitive.
It's come on loads now, hasn't it?
Yeah, massively. The first music software I ever used, actually before Cubase, was a PlayStation game called Music 2000, which was basically a library of loops.
Yeah, I remember that.
And you could change the tempo and you could, you know, choose from lots of, you could build beats from the loops. And I used to use that to make dance music. And then I had that small introduction to Cubase. And so then shifting to Logic, I think I was overwhelmed with how much it could do. And it wasn't, you know, Logic nowadays obviously is based off of GarageBand, which is quite user-friendly because of the users that that's aimed at.
Yeah.
Back then, Logic, you know, in 2006, 2007, Logic, I don't remember being particularly user-friendly.
No, I think it wasn't as a broader market. It was still kind of within that sort of pro market.
Yeah.
I mean, Vader was on, I mean, we did all the Enemy stuff on Logic that we did at Vader. And I think it was an expense thing, really. It was, you know, at the time, Pro Tools was, yeah, it has always been more expensive than Logic, but it was considerably more. It's weird. Pro Tools seems to have gone up in price and Logic seems to have gone down in price over the years. But yeah, and it's interesting because I remember, it was pretty far into our working relationship. It was on the second album. It was, what's the song called? When you phoned me on New Year's Day and we both notoriously...
Last Goodbye.
Last Goodbye, yeah. And you don't like New Year's Eve. I don't like New Year's Eve. And we were both just not hungover and perfectly fine and bored on New Year's Day. And we got together and we demoed. And I remember, even though we'd been working together for about a year and a half at that point, I didn't realise until that day that you could even play violin. And do you remember we just built that song up and you played everything, played the piano, and then you just built up this orchestra and stuff like that. And it was kind of like, you at that point, I realised, I hadn't given you as much credit, but you had a sort of a recording mind. You know, it was very intuitive to you. And on that day we did that, I was just kind of like this interface for you, just to translate all your ideas into the thing. And you listen to the demos that you do now, they're very concise. You know, they are detailed and they are sort of well thought out. And I think it was a kind of a natural progression for you. I think you've always had the recording brain and the production brain. What's your rig these days? What do you have?
So I've just got a current gen MacBook Pro, which runs the latest version of Logic. I've got some Adams monitors and an SSL interface which emulates the G series you've got here. And that's it. I like to keep it quite simple. Actually, probably one of my most important tools is the set of headphones that I've had since probably 2007. Audio Technica because I know them so well. Mm. They're one up from the standard, one up from these that we're using here, the bigger ones. But I just know them so well that when I don't trust what I'm hearing, you know, while I'm making a demo, you know, you can go and try it in your car. But if you change cars, you never quite know. Those headphones, I can hear stuff in them, and I know exactly what's going on. I'm just kind of hoping that they don't break.
Yeah, then you're screwed. You've got no reference. So do you work on headphones a lot?
Yeah.
Mainly headphones?
Yeah, I tend to do a lot of writing in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll get ideas down using headphones and then go to sleep and then wake up the next day and have the sort of the reveal of hearing them through the monitors, which is sometimes really, really good and sometimes absolutely terrible. But yeah, a lot of the stuff when I create, I'm creating in headphones, and I think there's something good about that. There's something, you know, these ideas are coming from inside you, and with headphones, it's like they're sort of piped directly back into you.
So they're not going too far away.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It's like they're not free to sort of float around the room yet, and you feel a bit like they're exempt from judgment because they're just in headphones, and so you know you feel a bit more free to just try this. And I really like working in headphones.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, your setup at home is it's a really nice room. It's quite an inspiring room. Do you tend to find you have to be in that room to write well? Is that now your go-to place, or can you kind of write anywhere?
I think it's my preferred place. I can probably write anywhere, but I'm happiest sat sort of facing just, you know, that wall.
Mm.
And there's very few distractions, but it's a nice, comfortable place. It sounds good. Everything's to hand. You know, everything's designed so that, you know, there's a jack lead that's hooked to the edge of the table. That's your guitar. But it's all, everything's plumbed in. So you either pick up a mic and start singing, or you pick up a guitar, plug it in and you go, or the keyboard is there in front of you already plumbed in. And that was a huge change for me, because I've had setups in the past where, you know, it required one or two steps.
Mm-hmm.
In order to go, oh, well, let's put some guitars down. I'll get the guitar out, or, all right, let me just run that lead from the interface.
Yeah, yeah.
Getting rid of all of that,
mm-hmm.
and having, you know, the rack of guitars next to you, the keyboard ready to go, even as far as having some templates made up in Logic, although that can be a blessing and a curse, because I think there is, when you've been creative, I think there are drawbacks to having go-to setups. You know, I know what my guitar sound is with the Enemy, for example, and it could be very easy to just grab the Enemy guitar and have the Enemy guitar sound ready to go. But you will inevitably, if you do that, end up playing something very similar to what you've played before, or it will sound very similar to what you've played before. And quite a lot of the times, getting a weird sound out of a guitar that you're not expecting.
Yeah, it takes you on a new journey.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this before, but I think when the digital audio workstation was created, it was effectively a new instrument. And I think, you know, as a songwriter, I mean, I certainly saw, I don't know, I think it didn't influence your songwriting as such, but it facilitated you to be able to broaden your imagination with your songwriting, would you say? And you embraced it as another instrument and another tool. Would you say that it did influence your songwriting?
It massively changed it, because it took out one of the chains of communication. So when you're in a creative process, to my mind, the fewer times that creative idea has to be communicated, the better, the more pure it will be. And so I had, my recording experience had been, I'm a musician and a songwriter in a studio with a producer and an engineer, and I can either let the producer dictate how it's going to sound, or I can try and communicate how I imagine it sounds to them, which means one of the links in the chain is now language, which means you're limited by the ability to explain what you want and the other person to understand it. The minute that I could take ownership of part of the process which could change the way it sounded, I negated the need to communicate what I was imagining. It was between me and the computer. Mm. It's, you know, right, how do I get this sound that I'm hearing? No, it's not quite that. Is it more this? And I also think it then, because I think there are two types of production. I think there are two types of producer. There is creative production, and then there's technical production. And what I'm doing in my studio set up at home is not technical production, as you can vouch for, because none of it is usable.
Well, no, saying that, that's not true, because we have used demo stems on more than one occasion.
The odd bit, and I think that is credit to Logic's sample library, which is very good, and there are sounds in there which actually, with just a bit of tweaking, you can use in a final a final piece. But in general, you know, I don't care about vocal chains. I don't care what compressor the vocal's going through. And the comes a point when, by the time you get to mixing, where I actually can't hear the difference as well. You know, I'll be working with George Perks, and he's adjusting things, and he'll A-B it, and I'll go, what do you think? And I go, I can't hear the difference. And if I can't hear the difference, I think that means that over 90% of the public also probably can't hear the difference.
And 90% of the public haven't spent 20 years standing in front of Liam Watts playing drums.
Well, yeah, true, yeah.
That might have something to
do with
it.
I've got a great ear. just left.
The one.
I never aspire to be a great technical producer. Mm. I don't care what mic you're using for the vocals. That's your bit. And when we work on a record together, that's your area. How you're miking up the kit, I don't care. What compressor chains it's going through and all of that.
Well, I mean, you don't even care what guitar effects pedals I put in the chain.
No, as long as it sounds close enough to what I've achieved in the box.
Yeah.
And so that's why my home studio, everything is in the box, because it's quick, it's easy, and it's not going to be kept, or the likelihood is it's not going to be kept. And the production that I'm doing there is what I would consider creative production. It's, I want some strings with a monumental reverb on it, and I'll put a monumental reverb on it, and I won't spend more than 5 minutes messing with what that reverb is, because then we'll go into the studio and you'll put a better monumental reverb on it, and then we'll end up in the studio with George mixing, and he'll take that one off and he'll put an even better one he's, you know, spent weeks going through plugins. And so for me, learning about, you know, DAWs was just a way to just remove a link in the chain. And because if I mess up, that's on me, and I'll be frustrated with myself, but I think, well, I'll do better next time. So if I listen to a record and I go, oh, that bit annoys me, I wish I'd done that differently, I'm annoyed with myself. And it's a lesson for me. Mm-hmm. If someone else messes up because something's been lost in translation, I find it so annoying. If I think, I explained to them how I wanted that, and listen to how it's come out, it's rubbish. I'm frustrated at them, and no lesson will be learned other than don't use them. And so it allowed me to just remove that bit of communication and that fallibility, and to take some more accountability myself for, you know, the process and then the end result.
Yeah. I mean, you've always kept things pretty simple. Everything's gone straight to the point, right down to the guitar rig and the enemy. It's like, it's one pedal, pretty much.
It's just a tuner now. There's no pedal.
You've stripped it back even further.
Yeah, I've just adjusted the pickup a little bit, and we've changed the amp that we use. And the enemy's guitar tone now is a custom shop Telecaster with all of the electronics removed and replaced with cheaper ones, because it was a really lovely, warm, low output sound from that Tele, which is not the enemy's sound. So a lot of Mexican bits in there, relatively cheap Seymour Duncan single coil on the bridge, neck does nothing, and it goes through a tuner, so I can mute it on stage directly into a Black Star Artisan, and all of the knobs are just turned all the way up apart from the volume, which sits around 3 or 4. That's the enemy's guitar thing.
So you don't even have your settings marked down at all?
Don't need to, no.
You don't need to.
Do it in the dark.
Yeah. And it sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, you work with a few producers. Obviously, we've done some records together, and you work with Mike Crossey, and you work with Gethin Pearson, and you work with Joby Ford.
Joby Ford, yeah.
And you've also worked with songwriters. You know, you work with a few songwriters.
Yeah.
Who have there been people that have been really inspired you that you've kind of walked away and gone, oh, I've had some ideas from them. They've actually given me some stuff.
There are little things that you take from everyone, some positive, some negative. I think Mike Crossey had such a focus on purity and quality of sound. You know, and he wanted to work to tape, and he was very specific about the tape he wanted to work to, and you know, that's carried through, because before we'd worked with Mike, as you can tell from the way the first record sounds, there wasn't that focus on, well, this needs to sound very, very good and rich.
It's raw.
Yeah. And Simon Barnicot, who did the first record, what I learned and took from him was experimentation. You know, he was sort of, right, let's mic this piano up, put it through a Fender valve amp, mic the amp up, put it through a plate delay, see how it sounds. That's on away from here. That's part of the, you know, it's in there on the track. And that sort of, well, let's just try it. I think I still love just messing around with stuff and going, right, well, what shouldn't you do? Let's try it. Even in the box as well, you know, even combos in the box where you'd go, well, that's ridiculous, that won't work. You just do it, you know. And then, yeah, I mean, by the time we were working with Joby's very, 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 very structured in the way he works in a studio, which obviously now, when you look at the way I work in a studio, I think I probably picked up on a bit of that.
Yeah.
You know, it was, you know, today we will achieve this, and we will get this done, and there's a clear plan, which, again, before we worked with Joby, we'd never had. It was, you will rock up to the studio, have a cup of tea, and talk about what you might do that day.
Yeah.
You know, there was no going in with a plan, and that's just because the budget got smaller, I guess, by the time we were working with Joby. You have to know what you're trying to achieve in the time you've paid for. And then working with Gethin, I learned a lot about sort of the power of demoing, because a lot of what really impressed us when we first started working with Gethin was his ability to. We would, you know, send him a demo, and he would send back what sounded like an already quite well-rounded piece of music with lots of layers on it that, you know, he'd just basically knocked up, you know, using plugins, and, you know, there'd be drums and several layers of synths, and there was guitar and bass on there, and none of them were the final ones, none were the keepers.
The pre-production, basically.
Yeah, you know, the pre-prod was a really high standard where you can already see what you're aiming for.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that, you know, the way that I work today is by the time I'm in a studio, we know exactly what we're walking out
there's,
with.
There's no grey area, is there? No, that's really interesting. And it's funny, I've spoken to a couple of people, and I think you pull a bit from everybody, because no two people are the same.
No.
Without, you know, they just aren't. And even so, you know, I think you can find producers that are very similar. They will still have a nuance about them that will make them different from everybody else. And you can, I think you can always hear it in their records. When I've met producers who've come to work at Vader, who I'm very familiar with their work and the records that they've done, a lot of the time, you know, I'll sit down and have a meal with them. And after that meal, I will immediately see the sort of correlation between that conversation, that personality that I've picked up, and their records.
Interesting.
You know? And I think it is very sort of coherent, and a definite sort of pattern. So, I mean, you pick up all these different things over the years, and obviously you've been, I mean, as I said, like, We Live and Die in These Towns, we did 18 years ago. Do you have now a real method? I suppose you do have a real method in the studio, don't you? Like a real kind of, you know, you have a specific environment that you like. You like it to be in a certain way in the certain hours, don't you, really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't like change. So I like having a format.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a format that we kind of accidentally developed, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, that if I look back at every record I've made, We'll Live and Die in These Towns, I was along for the ride. I was in charge of the songwriting and the performance,
yeah.
And everything else was, you know, dictated by a record label and a producer and an engineer. Music for the People, I was more involved in the production, but frankly, we had such a short time frame and we were recording to tape. There wasn't many, you know, there wasn't much of a focus on production. It was, how on earth am I going to get this record done? And not all of it's written, and we're in the studio, and it was panic stations. The third record was basically written to spec. It, you know, I was told by Cooking Vinyl what they needed, and they needed a straight down the line guitar album where the format of the songwriting followed the conventional Enemy format of the first record. And as a result, you know, I think that record's quite boring. The fourth record, we began to be able to experiment a bit, and I felt comfortable experimenting because by then I felt like it was probably all over anyway. I had a lot of fun making that record because we were experimenting, because we were pushing the envelope further than we'd been allowed to push it before.
You're introducing a lot more electronic influence into the music at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, and just where the songwriting goes, it was some of it was more vulnerable. It was a lot more sort of pop, you know, I think. I really enjoyed that. But then we really started developing the format that we work to now accidentally with Nigel. Mm. So I didn't mean to write Nigel. It just sort of happened. It started happening and I realised it was good and allowed it to continue happening. And I had a basic demo set up. I never thought we would actually make that record. I thought I was making it for myself and no one would hear it. And so I wanted to make it as good as I could for me to hear it. You know, there was no, oh, well, yeah, that piano will do because we'll replace it.
Mm.
It was, I want that piano to be as good as possible because that's the piano that I'm going to listen to forever when I listen to these songs that no one else is ever going to hear. And so those demos were made to quite a high quality. And so when I brought them to you, we had this incredibly detailed map of where we needed to go. And it meant that when I gave the demos to Andy, the session drummer, or Jim, who played the piano on that record, or when we passed it to Lee for the bass, it was there, note for note.
Mm.
And what that essentially meant was there were no songwriting or performance discussions taking place in the studio. They'd already been had, and we were there to capture sounds, better sounds than the ones that were on the demo. And the other part of the process, I guess, was the discussions before we even set foot in the studio about what we wanted to achieve with it. And they were lengthy, you know, hours and hours and hours before we recorded a note.
I certainly never made a record like that with that kind of pre-production and looking at every angle and the tying it up. And I'll be grateful if I get the opportunity again, because it was brilliant. It was so, I mean, obviously, you know, I've been making records for years and you get into a comfort zone. And when people sort of break your sort of method, it's like, well, that's not how I would go about it. But it didn't feel challenging. It felt really invigorating and fresh. And then I felt, when we'd finished the record, it felt like a huge victory as well, because we had stayed true to everything that we'd said in those lengthy meetings, like all the promises. And actually, I remember you saying about after that record, you said you'd never want to do a record in one sitting again.
No, I think, so the reason we had to approach it the way we did was budget. It was self-funded, tiny budget. And we had to, you know, capture things like string sections. And
it was the pandemic.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult record to make in that respect. So we had to know exactly what we were going to do in those sessions. And we had to do it in broken down sessions, it had to be, right, I can afford the drummer, like, you know, I can afford the studio for a day to do the drums now. Can we get the drums done in a day? Turns out we could. And then, okay, I'll come back in a few weeks when I've got some money and we'll do the guitars. But what I learned through doing it that way, having always just gone into a studio, booked it for a month and worked on it, is that you get this incredible perspective when you back away for a couple of weeks. You know, you work all day and you listen to stuff at the end of the day and your ears are completely, you know, completely fucked. And then you go home and you listen to it a few days later and you kind of go, oh, yeah, I think I can be a bit more objective now. But if you go and live with that for, you know, a few weeks even, and you listen to it on different stereos or in your car or in different contexts, you know, even just listen to it sat in your lounge as opposed to on your rig, things reveal themselves to you that you will not see otherwise. Glaring things where you go, oh wow, I'm glad we've got the opportunity to correct this. You know, I'm glad this hasn't been sent off to be mixed already. And now it's those breaks in between sessions are an integral part of the process.
I mean, it's funny, there's quite a few bands I've been working with that have actually also been working like that, and it is that perspective that you get from drawing away is so helpful. Because there are, I think everybody's made records where, for whatever reason, you feel like you might not have had as much time as you would like. And, you know, you might listen to those records 2, 3, 4, 5 years later and you kind of have that, oh, yeah, I wish that was different.
I think you can have too much time as well, though.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, if you're just in a studio and you know you've got loads of time, you can just disappear up your own ass quite easily.
Yeah.
You can overproduce stuff or you can overthink stuff. And actually, I think having those short sessions where you go, right, we're in for 2 days and we've got to get guitars done, you just get the guitars done. And at the end of it, they sound right because there's something, there's a subconscious urgency that drives you to just perform well. And, you know, and if you're sitting around and you're too relaxed, well, number one, are you really on the ball? And number two, do you just end up taking roads that are not the right road to your destination? I've certainly experienced that in a studio where you go, oh, let's try this, and you've recorded a whole song that never gets used.
Yeah. It just goes too far to the left. But, you're quite unusual because, I mean, particularly now, you know, we've been working on some of your solo records and then you'll go home after a day's work in the studio and that night I'll get demos from you for the next record that you're already writing. So you appear these days, certainly for the last, I'd say, 3 years, to now almost be constantly juggling more than one record, whether you be recording one or writing another. Have you found that is a really another way to kind of like re-energize the writing process and the recording process to keep this juggling? Because you never, back in the Enemy days, then, you know, an Enemy record would sort of take a lot out of you. I suppose there was more people in more corners talking in your ear. But, you know, when you're on a run, it's like I've seen just this prolific nature on top of the fact that you're making a record in the studio at the same time. Have you found that there's this thing, they worked hand in hand together recently?
I don't really know. And I don't know if I've given it much thought. And I feel like if I do give it thought, I might not be able to write songs ever again. But I think, to be honest, before the Enemy had a record deal, I was very prolific. You know, there were over 30 songs written that were available for that first Enemy record, and they were written in 3 months.
Yeah.
Then the record industry got involved, and lots of people who've never written a record in their life started telling me how to write records. I got incredibly confused and found it very difficult to write records. The minute that all of the industry went away, because I was no longer a cash cow for them, I suddenly remembered how to write records. and And ever since then, you know, since Nigel, I've been really prolific. And we've, you know, the day that we finished recording Nigel here, I went home and started writing Aliens.
Yeah.
And then whilst writing Aliens, we put together the other side from B-sides and songs that had been cast aside during the writing of both records. Mm. And then, as well as that, I'll sit at home and just demo some classical arrangements or make some jazz just as an outlet for myself. So, there's, you know, there is always writing going on, even if it's not being used. It's a constant thing. And, you know, as soon as we started then demoing, as soon as we started recording Aliens, you know, tracking for Aliens, the next one was being demoed at home. There is something about, I find, being creative. So if I'm in the studio working and I'm around other creative people, it inspires me and I'll go home and I'll write more stuff.
Mm.
If I have a break and I'm not around creativity, that's normally when I hit a bit of a lull and I don't write so much stuff. I think a lot of people are like that. I think a lot of people write on tour, but I find tour so stressful. Generally, that tends to...
I was going to say, I mean, you're right in the middle of a solo tour at the moment, and you're not writing at all at the moment.
No, I won't write anything while I'm on tour. I'll finish tour and then get back into the headspace and finish writing the Enemy record and then pick up the solo stuff again. But, touring and writing are two totally separate headspaces for me, and I can't mix them.
Mm.
Touring just shuts down the creative process, because touring is not a creative process for me. It's, we go out and we play the exact same thing every night, the exact same way. There might be, you know, I might milk an ending a little bit or something, or, you know, there might be tiny adjustments. But when I'm on tour, what I'm actually doing has nothing to do with performing music. It's all crowd work. That's why the Enemy shows, the crowds go really mad, is because by the time if you're walking on stage thinking, let's try and play this really, really well, you've already fucked up.
Yeah.
Because you should be able to play it really, really well from muscle memory. Your job in front of a crowd is to work the crowd, and you rely on your muscle memory to play the songs.
Mm.
And so working a crowd isn't really a creative task. It's a reactive one, and I get really anxious about it. But for whatever reason, it gets me out of that creative headspace, and I just don't write while I'm on tour.
Yeah, it's interesting. So many artists, you hear that, you know, they wrote that record on the back of a tour bus, and you know. But as you say, everybody is completely different. The interesting thing I was going to ask you is, like, obviously we've discussed that your approach in how you write, and obviously the fact that you've implemented recording into your writing, and you're very proactive with your recording, and you've established a new working method within the actual studio as well. How do you think that's going to change making another Enemy record? Because things are so different from when they were.
Yeah, when I came to start demoing this Enemy record, I didn't really know where to start, because the last few records that we've made, you know, Nigel was such an out there record, you know, string arrangements, there's accordions, and it's a weird instrumentally, it was a very weird record compared to the meat and two veg that the Enemy had delivered on the previous four records. And then Aliens, much the same. The other side was about reverse engineering the 90s and about trying to find that nostalgic sound that, you know, I grew up with listening to those records. And I came to write The Enemy, and I've had this amazing freedom. And it goes back to what I was saying about having your guitar, your sound there ready to go. With all the solo records, I don't want my sound. I want a totally different sound that I've never heard, or I want a sound from a soundtrack I've just heard watching a film or something. And all of a sudden I had to go, right, so it's going to be a Telecaster into, you know, straight into an amp with quite a bit of gain on a high output pickup. And that's the guitar sound, because that is the Enemy's guitar sound, and it's what people expect. And it's more like writing and demoing to a spec again. And so I basically, before I wrote anything, before I demoed anything, I approached The Enemy the way that I've approached the solo stuff. So, you know, one of the solo records I've reverse engineered 50s and 60s sort of recording and production and gone, okay, that's how we do that. Another one I've reverse engineered sort of 60s, 70s into 80s prog. And I basically just tried to reverse engineer 2000s indie and pick the best bits. And that was sort of where I had to pick up writing for The Enemy. But honestly, it's been much harder than writing solo records.
Mm.
Trying to do it almost to a brief, but also offer something new and exciting and not just repeat yourself, is much harder than having the freedom of, it's the 50s and there's been a murder.
Yeah, I suppose with the solo stuff, anything goes. You know, there's nothing that sort of goes, oh, you can't do that because that's not Tom Clark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the solo stuff, you've already kind of begun to map out that your parameters are broad, whereas that there is an expectancy to The Enemy. But, I mean, do you think it's the new way or new approach? I mean, the way in which you are much more proactive in the demo stages. I mean, I used to do demos with The Enemy before any of you sort of had rigs. I mean, Andy, obviously, he's got a recording mm-hmm. rig as well, and he does stuff. Would you say that this stage and having that facility is an enhancement or a hindrance?
I don't know yet.
Yeah, right.
I mean, so far it seems to be working, and the stuff that we're demoing, we're really happy with and really excited to record.
That sounds very exciting to me.
But ultimately, I don't think you know whether a record has been a creative success until about 5 years afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, like, it can be a sales success or it can be a sales flop, but, you know, you can listen to a record that was a sales flop and go, my God, that's such a good record. And equally, you can listen to a record that was a huge hit and go, God, there's so much wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think to call
Where do you hold the value? Do you hold it in commercial success or artistic success?
It depends what the project is.
Mm.
So if it's my solo stuff, it's all about the artistic value. Mm. You know, it's about, will this stand the test of time? When I'm gone and someone stumbles on this record, will they listen to it and will it still translate? And will they go, oh, this is good, I like this? And then with a more commercial product like The Enemy, I think you have to consider, you know, this has to wash its own face. This is, it's got to be successful to a point. It's got to be appealing to the fans because it needs to keep driving the touring, and it's a business, you mm. know, the my solo stuff, we make it. It sells some records. It usually pays for itself, not always. And that's fine because it's basically just me and you making it.
Mm.
And, you know, The Enemy comes with the responsibility of Liam and Andy have to be happy with this. Mm. They've got to go out and perform it. They're putting their names to it as well.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, this has got to be good enough that we're able to keep getting good gig offers when this comes out, you know, that it's not perceived as a complete flop, because the touring not only pays our bills, but, you know, all of our technicians that we employ, we need to be able to offer them consistent work in order to keep employing them and get reasonable mm. rates from them.
Mm.
And it needs to pay back IMG, Joe, who puts the records out, who's an independent record label. It needs to be worthwhile for Joe and worth IMG's time. There's a lot more that rides on the commercial success of The Enemy, of an Enemy record, than a solo one. And so I will inevitably make that record with an eye on, do I think this will be commercially successful? Shall I leave out the 2-minute track that is an accordion solo that went on Nigel, you know? It's you have to understand the different value of different products.
So, I mean, again, you're pretty well versed in this. You've done this a few times, and the one thing I'm always interested in is the two questions I ask people is their toughest moment in the studio, and then probably their funniest moment or most magical moment in the studio.
So the toughest, I think, was quite early on in the Enemy's career, on the first record, working with Owen Morris. I found that incredibly difficult. Owen's a very talented producer, and he's worked on some of the biggest records of, you know, my generation that we grew up with, listening to, you know, his involvement with Oasis and The Verve. And he's got his process. And it could not clash with my process more.
Right.
You know, Owen's process seems to be of sort of hedonism and consumption, and I go into a studio to work in a very conventional way. I'm there to get a job done to the best of my ability. So, you know, I don't drink that much anyway these days, but I would never drink while I was working. I want all of my senses to be as acute as possible, because what you're doing when you're recording something is you're making a record of something, and I want that record it's going to last forever.
Yeah.
It needs to be the absolute best that I can do, and I don't want my judgment impaired. Owen's really rock and roll, and he rolls into a studio, and, you know, he's got, certainly at the time we were working with him, he's got his beers on the side and, you know, whatever else he's enjoying. And the working hours will sometimes be really, really late, and sometimes it'll be, I'm done, let's go to the pub. And, you know, I found that very challenging, especially making the first record, because for me this was, we've got this huge opportunity here.
Yeah.
We're working with Warner Brothers. I've seen their logo on the start of all the films I've watched, and I don't want to fuck this up. And you've got someone else there who's kind of been around the block, and it's like, oh, fuck the label, you know, like, well, like, this will be fine. And I found that the whole time we were working with Owen, so we started working with him on It's Not Okay, which made the record, his version made the record. And then we recorded Had Enough. I actually wrote We'll Live and Die in These Towns, the song, on one of Owen's sessions. But I just, everything was so manic and so messy. And I, like, you know, I like things to be in order, and I like a predictable format. And so I found that really, really hard. And it's not, that's no criticism of Owen. He's a legend.
Yeah.
But I just really struggled with that type of process.
Yeah, it just didn't work for you.
Yeah.
I mean, with regards to the, I mean, I don't know whether you want to pick a magical or a funny one, but I mean, there's so many funny moments in the Enemy career that I can remember being in the studio with you boys that I wouldn't even know where to start.
Yeah, in terms of my funniest moment in a recording studio, it involves Andy, and it's his story really, and I can't tell it. But anyone who was there still remembers it and still laughs about it to this day. And it's cemented Andy as a legend in my head forever. But I can't tell the story. So in terms of most magical, it was a mix of most magical and most terrifying. Was the day we put the strings down for Nigel. It was absolutely just, I can't believe we're here. We've got to this point. There is a string section in a 750-year-old chapel.
Yeah, it was pretty magical, wasn't it?
Playing music that I wrote that's been arranged beautifully by Jim. And it's working. And it was absolute hairs on the back of the neck moment until the power went out.
Yeah.
And at which point I went from the highest high I've had whilst recording to the most scared and upset that I've ever been whilst recording, because I did not have the budget to bring the string section back on another day.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were halfway through, and I just thought, you know, we had Osu to do yet, which was the big one. It's like, there's no way the strings are done. And I just, the bottom fell out of my world. But once we got the power back on, it immediately went back to being the most magical moment I've ever had in a studio, just listening to them put this music down that I never thought me and you would get to make that sort of music.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that thing, that day, that New Year's Day when we did the demo for Last Goodbye, it's funny when I remember sitting there doing the strings with you that day, and that New Year's Day went through my head and it was all making sense, going like, that was the precursor to this. Like, because I, as I said, it was, I remember you going, right, have you got a violin? And I was like, well, yeah, we've got an old one around, kicking around the studio. We're like, oh, like, I want to put some strings on it. And I remember going, well, you can play violin. And it was funny. And then hearing this opus, because I think Nigel's a record that we're both really, really proud of. Because it still seems such a satisfying listen now, a couple of years after we've done it. And you know what it's like, you listen to your own work and there's always a little bit of a, and I just listened to that with real happiness. But it was, yeah, my moment on that, when those strings were going down, my mind just went straight back to that. God, when was that? Would that have been 2008?
Probably around then.
Yeah. And it was almost like, this was the opus that was to come from that. Yeah, that was a really special moment. That was nice to be able to share that, but I also do remember the power cut.
That moment for me signified a sort of the early part of my career, I desperately tried to communicate what I wanted to create, and so often it would be misinterpreted or not achieved. And so I would try and just do everything myself. So I'd go, right, okay, I know what the string arrangement needs to be in my head. I'll play the violins and I'll put it down and I will try and create that. And Nigel was the first time where the demos were good enough because of the amount of work that had gone in pre-production that I could hand the strings over to Jim and say, produce this in dots. And Jim did an amazing job. And I could hand the piano playing over to Jim and say, look, I've written the piano part, but I know you can perform it better than me. And the communication is done because here's all the MIDI.
Yeah.
You know, you can just learn it. And it's having that ability to demo at home to a high standard just made, there is still communication there, but the communication is so much more effective than words because it's MIDI. And you can look at what I want you to do. There's the dots. You can look at it on a score if you want and just replicate it, but replicate it better than I ever could playing a violin myself or playing a piano myself. And that whole studio session of that record, to be honest, even, you know, Lee putting the bass down, I was just aware that I was working with people who were better than me. And I think lots of people in business will always tell you, you know, that a good CEO, their job is to surround them with people that are smarter than them, that can do things that you can't, and then to direct them. And that's exactly what we did with Nigel. And listening to all of that come together with, as the strings went down, and thinking the last thing to go, you know, the only thing we've got to do on this is vocals, and I'm going to be singing over this wonderful string section, and Lee's absolutely nailed the bass better than I ever could, and Jim's played the piano with so much passion, was just, I'm going to be singing on a record better, you know, on a record that sounds better than I could have made on my own. That was the most magical feeling, was this has surpassed what I thought I could achieve.
Well, Tom, it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you so much for coming and chatting to me.
It's been a pressure.
Pressure. I know someone that wrote a song about that. And I'm really looking forward to doing this Enemy record. I guess we'll all look forward to the outcome. Let's hope we pull it off.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.